First of all, I assume it's been a tough year for a lot of us out there, so let me wish you a holiday season that will bring you many moments of peace, love, warmth, reflection, connection, laughter, and infectious joy. And may we all enjoy a better, fairer, and happier 2010. I will be with you again next week, but obviously the 27th of December is a time when people may be far away from Los Angeles, far away from their radios, etc. Today's guest, Mark Hertzgaard, blogging from Copenhagen for Vanity Fair after Obama's speech this week, wrote, and I'm going to read a quote, "He came, he saw, he disappointed." As President Barack Obama arrived in Copenhagen on Friday morning for the last day of the UN Climate Summit, all eyes were upon him. Only Obama, the argument went, had the power and prestige to break the deadlock at this summit, widely regarded as humanity's last good chance to preserve a livable climate. But hopes that the president would bring something new to Copenhagen, that the U.S. position would move closer to what science says is required to avoid catastrophic climate change, were dashed by the president's surprisingly lackluster remarks. And that was Friday morning, Pacific time. And for the next hour today, a jet-lagged Mark Hertzgaard will be my guest to talk climate, Copenhagen, Obama, what happened, how and why did it happen, what needs to happen, what's likely to happen, and what can we do. Mark Hertzgaard, a fellow of the Open Society Institute, he's the nation's environment correspondent. He covers climate change for Vanity Fair, Time, Die Zeit, and has written for many of the world's leading newspapers and magazines. He's the author of several books, including the highly acclaimed study of the media during the Reagan years called On Bended Knee. That was quite prescient, really, for everything we've seen ever since then. Other books include Earth Odyssey, A Day in the Life, The Music and Artistry of the Beatles, The Eagle's Shadow, and the forthcoming Generation Hot, Living Through the Storm of Climate Change. Welcome, Mark Hertzgaard.
Always happy to be with you, Terrence.
Ah, thank you. When did you get into San Francisco? My fear this morning was that the storms on the east might have caught you halfway.
That was my fear, but I snuck away.
Very good. Very good. And I really appreciate when I first asked you to do this, you said, well, I'll either be on my way. If it's extended, I'll still be there, or I'll just be dead tired. So thank you for giving us this hour.
Happy to do it.
Okay. You've been focusing on the issues around climate change for months now, perhaps for years, and you're working on a book about it, as I just said. You've just returned from Copenhagen to your home, your family. I know you have a young child. How are you feeling about the way humanity is responding?
Well, humanity, I think, is doing okay. Our governments and political leaders are not doing so well. You know, there's no disguising the fact that Copenhagen was a terrible, terrible shortcoming and really almost a disaster. Don't be misled, by the way, everybody, about the headlines that you've been reading over the last 24 hours that a deal, quote-unquote, was made in Copenhagen. The actual UN climate summit there did not endorse the U.S.-backed agreement. Even Barack Obama called this agreement, quote, a political declaration. So it involved some of the big emitters. And I suppose if we'd had this kind of a political declaration 10 years ago, we would have hailed it as progress. But now it is really, really very discouraging. And it opens the question, I think, of how do you proceed from here? Are these big international meetings simply too unwieldy to deliver the kind of progress that science says we need?
Mm-hmm. And I want to get back to that at the end, but I want to do, if you're with me on this, Marcus, for folks who either have been in a cave or have been overwhelmed by too much information, which I think you know both happen. I want to go over a little bit what the current situation is and then dive into Copenhagen and then where we go from there. What is the current consensus of the situation regarding global climate change? That means what have all our research led us to at this moment? What's the latest? What does science say and what do policymakers say?
Let's start with the science. The science is now really unequivocal and unfortunately getting more and more desperate as we speak. Every week, it seems, brings more and more information indicating that not only is humanity changing the climate through our emissions of greenhouse gases, but that the climate is changing much faster and in much more disturbing ways than scientists expected. Even Jim Hansen, the NASA scientist who has been really a leader on this for 20 years, has told me that he was surprised at how quickly climate change has come. And it's, since we're starting here at the beginning, it's probably worthwhile to emphasize that global warming and climate change are not the same thing. Global warming refers to the rise in temperatures that is caused by the greenhouse effect and by our emissions of carbon dioxide and methane and other gases. And that science has been settled for a long time, since really the 1990s. We know that the temperatures were going up and that it's related to the greenhouse gases. What has been the most unnerving over the last 5 to 10 years is how quickly global warming has triggered climate change. And even people like Jim Hansen in the 1990s, when they were warning about global warming, did not expect it to trigger climate change, which is to say the extra strong droughts, the floods, the changes in weather patterns. They did not expect that to happen until the year 2100.
Wow. Let me just say two things. One, the difference between 2010 and 2100 in the scale of this sort of thing is phenomenal. And second, let me just ask, because something like the melting of glaciers, that you still count as global warming? So what you're talking about is things that you could not call global warming but seem to be the effects of what's going on?
No, global warming is simply the rise in temperatures.
Mm-hmm.
And that we have measured very carefully. Climate change are all the things that causes.
Oh, okay. So that includes the glacial melt.
Includes glacial melt and includes the shift of species, the migration of species to different places. You know, and sort of the headline on this is that climate change arrived 100 years sooner than anyone expected.
Wow. Let me just say that for me, the most potent moments, the first time that I saw Al Gore's slideshow that later became An Inconvenient Truth, and to this day, is the photos of the loss of glaciers, which I just brought up. That seems to me that powerful kind of information, whether it's the Himalayas or the Andes. And what is the latest progress report on those?
Well, since you and I are both here in California, I know we're being listened to nationwide, but let's not forget the Sierra Nevada. Here in California, the loss of the glaciers at the top of the Sierra Nevada, that's our water source. That's responsible for about 40% of all the fresh water here in California. And so losing that is extremely serious. Now, in terms of the latest science, your question, actually Gore gave a presentation at Copenhagen that talked about how we are losing these glaciers so much faster than expected. And it's a different rate depending on where in the world it is occurring. Here in California, it's going so fast that I recently interviewed the scientist at Yosemite, and he said, you know, we're losing these glaciers. We're already to the point that the visitors to the park are seeing much less snow on top of these mountains. And he said, essentially, what that means is that all of the animals and the plants that are up there at between the very top of the mountain and down here at the valley floor, we're going to lose those because there's not going to be any way to get them water. So the really big one that most people worry about the most, of course, are the Himalayas.
Because that is what...
1 billion people that rely on that.
Right, India and China and others depend on that. The other one that I've read that's really accelerating are the Andes that feed Peru and Bolivia.
That's correct.
So these are, that which, as I say, when you see it in a photo, it kind of makes you, it takes you back. But the effect of that on water, which is both, you know, essential to life and essential to agriculture and essential to generating power, all of these things I think we take for granted, is really, as we're agreeing, is really accelerating and alarming. So, The big point you're making is climate change is surprising even the people who have been studying this, and that climate change, as you've defined it, is the result of global warming, which we know, which we've known for a while was the case, but the climate change, the effects are faster, more drastic. There's acidification of the oceans as well?
That's come on the radar screen recently, and while that's not entirely related to to global warming. It is extremely, extremely serious because the oceans are essentially, they're the reason that we have a livable climate on this planet. And at the rate that we're going, we are going to kill the oceans. The oceans are essential for many different reasons, just related to climate change. They are a buffer. They are now, they are what scientists call a sink, in the sense that they capture a lot of the CO2 that we put up into the atmosphere. And unfortunately, when they capture it and absorb it, it leads to acidification of the water there. And among the many damaging impacts is that basically it makes it much, much harder for shellfish to form their shells, and it attacks the corals and the base of the marine food chain. Let's bear in mind, 1 billion people around the world rely on the sea for their main source of protein through shellfish and fish. So, you know, we're going very rapidly in the wrong direction. And the thing about Copenhagen was that many people hoped that that would begin to turn this around.
Right. In other words, what you're saying is that the last major agreement, Kyoto, whatever one thinks about it, et cetera, there was a lot of new information that was in people's hands by the time they met in Copenhagen, and yet their actions have not kept pace with what we've learned. Let me deal with one thing that we heard a lot about prior to and during Copenhagen, just to get it out of the way, and that is what the climate change deniers have called climate gate. The hacking of computers at East Anglia in the UK, their research, and the distribution of what were claimed to be revealing emails and so on. What was in those emails? Do we have any idea who hacked? And what's your assessment of their meaning?
Right. those emails are much ado about nothing, is my take on it. And I recommend to people a story by the Associated Press. The single best analysis of this was by Associated Press reporter Seth Borenstein and a number of others. It was published about 2 weeks ago. You can find it by Googling Associated Press and hacked climate emails. And they read through every one of them. I do not claim to have read through every one of them. There were literally millions. And the long and short of it is that, guess what? Scientists say nasty things about other people in their private emails. But as the AP said, their headline was something to the effect of climate science, or emails show climate science, it's not pretty, but it's not faked.
Uh-huh.
And in short, you know, these guys, the data all holds together, and they do say nasty things about their opponents and their critics. And, gee, I sure am glad that doesn't happen in any other sphere of American life, like politics or business or families. I mean, come on.
Yeah. Let me ask about two things that have given people pause in just talking to folks lately. The two that one person who said, you know, I'm not sure how I feel these days because of. One was the fact that the initial research where they pulled together a lot of different studies, they destroyed, okay, and that's one. The second one is that I think the most quoted email, which was that Mike's trick of, you know, inserting these different temperatures has taken care of the decline. I'm paraphrasing, but that's basically
right.
It. Those two things, which are the thing I think which have caused some people pause.
Right. Well, again, look, the people who believe that this is such a terrible scandal and who believe that global warming isn't real, it doesn't matter what I say or anybody says. You're not going to change their mind. It's like talking to them about evolution. They don't believe in evolution either. So I preface my remarks with that. I don't expect the people whose minds are made up to change. But the rest of us should be a little more skillful about seeing what's going on here and putting it in context. These are people who have never wanted to believe this, who have been attacking this forever. Specifically on this point about the quote-unquote trick, anybody who knows science, and indeed the scientists said this afterwards, that word trick is something that scientists use to say not as in a deceit, but as in a clever little maneuver that you use when you are putting data together. You know, you mentioned before, I have a young child. I have a four-year-old daughter. We talk about tricks all the time, but it's not that they're trying to deceive. It's just a way of calculating data that makes it easier to present.
Right. Trick is more a clever move than a deceitful one.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And if you look, you know, East Anglia is just one of the four sources, chief sources around the world that do the temperature calculations. And all the other three come down, you know, pretty darn close to what Anglia said.
Yeah.
So as far as I'm concerned, I think the best line actually on these, on the emails, is that it came from Al Gore, who said that, look, the climate deniers, it's kind of like a sunset. This is their last big hurrah. And just like the sunset, when the sun is going down, there's that one bursting moment before it disappears beneath the horizon. And that's this episode for the deniers. Nobody, that was very striking in Copenhagen, by the way, and that's one sign of
good, good. Progress. Thank you. This is something
nobody
good.
Takes that seriously.
Yeah.
There.
In other words, big news in the blogosphere, no news in Copenhagen.
Big news in the American blogosphere, I would say.
Okay.
Nobody in Europe or anywhere else takes that seriously.
Thank you, though. And by the way, the person, the one specific person I was referring to was not a climate change denier or a creation, you know, an evolution denier. She was more of a libertarian who thought, you know, some more government information not to trust and so on. So that's why I did want to deal with that, because I think there are some people that may unsettle. Okay. Next, another flurry news came about early last week, you know, the revelation of the Danish text and how this had upset people. What was the Danish text?
The Danish text, that turned out to be one of these cases where, in my view at least, the other side, the sort of the activist side, was overstating the facts.
Uh-huh. No surprise, really.
Much more conspiratorial. But their argument was, and it appeared on the front page of the Guardian newspaper of Great Britain, you know, they're not the only ones saying this, but that the Danish government had circulated a draft text for a potential agreement at the summit, and that this draft text supposedly was very strongly biased against developing countries, that it released the developed countries from making any emissions cuts. It said that any monies that would be distributed to developing countries would go through the World Bank, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And it's funny, Terrence, because I was actually on the plane on my way towards Copenhagen, and I was flying Virgin, and so they have free Wi-Fi, so I was online, and my Vanity Fair editor emailed me while I was in the air, and he said, you know, what do you know about this? And so I said, well, let me read the text first. And so I read the actual text, and the actual text did not contain any of those statements made by the Guardian report. And so I thought, well, maybe I'm missing something. So I checked with some of my sources on the ground in Copenhagen, and who have been, you know, activists who've been following this for a long time, and I said, am I missing something? And they said, no, you're not. This is a tempest in a teapot. And sure enough, within 24 hours, one of the chief activists quoted in the Guardian story, who runs the humanitarian group Oxfam in the UK, he had put around an email disavowing the quote that was attributed to him.
Wow.
So
wow.
It just goes to show, you know, there's plenty of room for people on all sides of this to believe what they want to believe and not to check the facts.
Right. When you've got a hot issue, pardon the pun, and when you've got, you know, a big focus, and when you've got people wanting to scoop and get headlines, et cetera.
Exactly.
So finally, you've mentioned the activists a couple of times. Let me ask you a bit about the activity outside the hall, both in Copenhagen and around the world. On December 16th, you wrote a blog post about a planetary movement.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what was the effect of this planetary movement beyond Copenhagen and within Copenhagen, and what might we expect going forward?
That is one of the real hopeful signs of the last 2 weeks in Copenhagen, is that I think we've now seen the emergence and really the coming of age of a climate movement that is at the mass grassroots level. It is global, it is credible, and it is surprisingly influential. You may have seen last Saturday on the 12th, there was a worldwide day of climate change demonstrations in Copenhagen. We had 100,000 people marching through the streets, but there were over 3,000 other separate individual actions all around the world, and they were coordinated by some groups, including this group called 350.org that was founded by the author and now activist Bill McKibben, who wrote what was the first and, in many ways, still the essential book on climate change called The End of Nature. He published that in 1989.
Yep.
And Bill has, who I've known for years, has now, because he's seen so little progress coming from the political system, he made the rather important step of shifting from being a journalist into an activist, and he co-founded this group, 350.org, to argue that we need to get the world back to 350 parts per million carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. That's the safe level. And that came from studies by Jim Hansen of NASA, but that same goal has been reiterated and supported by Rajendra Pachauri, who's the head of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, and many other notables. What was interesting in terms of the movement is that figure of 350 parts per million, the movement was not just hollering on the outside. That has now, they put that squarely on the agenda in Copenhagen. We had 100 countries around the world endorsing a goal of 350 parts per million. Most of those countries, of course, were the poor and the vulnerable, many of the island states who are feeling the effects of climate change now and are saying that we've got to be much, much more ambitious about reducing the emissions than is currently on offer from the big emitters.
Let me just read this here. The Alliance of Small Island States, AOSIS, issued a proposed treaty that, like the worldwide protest Saturday, called for reducing the level of CO2 to 350, as you said. Not only the U.S., but also China and other big emitting nations consider talk of 350 naive, even crazy talk. Going into the summit, 92 countries had endorsed that target. So this is, I must say, I had Bill McKibben on right around the time he had started 350, just before, I think, the first series of actions a couple of years ago. And it was a phenomenal thing. This was a guy who lives in a small town in Vermont. I mean, you know, he was in New York for a while as a writer, and that was too urban and crazy for him. Moves to Vermont, you know, becomes a writer. That he had that one book that was just, you know, very smallly focused on his own life, and then makes this decision, and it has had a profound effect. I think it's quite an interesting personal journey.
Yeah, and you people who want to find out more, go to the website at 350.org, and you will see some absolutely stunning and, I must say, inspiring and beautiful pictures from around the world from the actions of the December 12th mass day of demonstrations. There are people now all over the world who get this and are going to keep pushing for this. There's just no question. They are not going to go away. And I think this is a movement that the governments and the corporations and other mainstream institutions are going to have to deal with for years to come.
I'm going to read a quote from Bill McKibben and then a quote from Evo Morales, the president of Bolivia. McKibben, in the face of leaked UN documents showing that this agreement is a sham, we were hoping for some movement from the president. And when McKibben says a sham, I believe what he's saying is that it goes so far short of aiming for 350. Instead, his response was take it or leave it. 100 other nations are not making reasonable demands because they want to make the president's life harder. It's because they would like their countries to actually survive the century. That's Bill McKibben. And then Evo Morales, the president of Bolivia, in his speech in Copenhagen, I believe, said the second climate debt is the use, and this is an interesting way of looking at it, is the use of atmospheric space by the developed countries. It's not possible that atmospheric space be the exclusive property of just a few countries for their development, that the countries that are irrationally industrialized have taken over with their greenhouse gases the atmospheric space. To pay this debt, they should reduce their emissions and absorb their greenhouse gases in a way that there exists a fair distribution of atmospheric space between all of the countries, taking into consideration their population, because the countries that are on the path of development need atmospheric space for their development. So those are a couple of voices from those who obviously found the ultimate agreement, which, as Mark pointed out at the top, is not any sort of a signed agreement, but sort of an understanding, an agreement of understanding at the end of the Copenhagen meetings. Mark Hertzgaard, what ultimately, let's shift now to what was, we're going to talk about Obama, we're going to talk about the U.S. and the U.S. role first. What did Obama and Wen, the of China, accomplish prior to Copenhagen? And then what was sort of the soap opera between the two countries during Copenhagen?
Good question. I think the let's start with the fact that the U.S. and China are now the two superpowers on this planet of many things, but in particular of climate change. We are the two nations that are producing the most greenhouse gases on an annual basis. Together we put up about 42% of the greenhouse gases per year. But that also obscures a very important fact that gets to the heart of the disagreement between Obama and Wen, which is that the United States is by far the world's leading carbon polluter because we have been polluting for centuries, because we industrialized sooner. We, of all the carbon dioxide, there's now 390 parts per million up in the atmosphere. And of all of that carbon dioxide and other gases that are up there, the United States is by far responsible for the largest amount. And that's simply because we, along with the other industrial countries, especially Britain and Germany, we've been burning coal a lot longer. We've been cutting forests a lot longer. We've been burning gasoline and plowing farmland and all of these things that release greenhouse gases. We've been doing it a lot longer than China has. It will take China until about 2030, even at current rates, before China reaches the U.S. level on a cumulative basis. And it's the cumulative emissions of carbon dioxide that drive climate change, not the annual. The annual is important, obviously, but it's the cumulative that really matter, and the cumulative are why international law requires the rich industrial countries to act first and to, in terms of cutting their emissions, and also to provide financial assistance to the poor countries who are the victims.
What is that international law, Mark?
That is the treaty that was signed at Rio in 1992 at the Earth Summit, signed, by the way, by the first President Bush, George Henry Walker Bush, signed the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change. That is still the treaty that we're working from today. The Kyoto Protocol was a protocol to that large...
Within that framework.
Yeah. And the negotiations in Copenhagen were about extending that same treaty. So we're still bound by that treaty, and that treaty requires the U.S. and other countries to do the things I mentioned before.
Wow.
And that's because of the historical emissions, and that's one of the main problems here, especially in the United States, where now the climate coverage in the media says, oh, China's the biggest emitter. Well, that's a very, very misleading way of looking.
Yeah, in other words, that would be true if we were dealing with something like that if you do it today, it happens today.
Yeah, the analogy I like to use is, and this gets also to what President Morales of Bolivia said, it's like, you know, you fill up a glass with from a pitcher of water, and you fill that glass three-quarters of the way full. And if you keep filling it, it's going to spill over. And then you pretend that, okay, well, we're going to start now and talk about how we're going to share that last quarter of the glass.
Yeah.
And the other people say, well, we haven't had anything to drink yet. And we say, oh, no, let the past be the past. And Obama said that a number of times this week. It's fundamentally dishonest.
Right. Well, let me just even read. Todd Stern, Obama's chief climate negotiator, when he, these are quotes from him, categorically rejects the suggestion that rich industrial countries owe compensation to the victims of climate change. He says, we absolutely recognize our historic role in putting emissions in the atmosphere, but Stern added, the sense of guilt or culpability or reparations he categorically rejects, saying we didn't know at the time as a defense, correct?
He did say that. He also said emissions are emissions, as if emissions long ago are the same as today. Todd Stern, I've been in meetings with him. He certainly knows better than that. He's talking out of both sides of his mouth. And it is true. Now, let's be fair, though. It is true that, you know, when my parents and my grandparents were growing up in the earlier part of the century, we did not know that burning coal and driving our cars was driving climate change. That only became, that issue was put on the international agenda in 1988 by Jim Hansen in Congress, and we've really only known for sure for the last 20 years that that was a serious probability. Fair enough. But in the last 20 years, we have completely avoided the so-called precautionary principle of environmental policymaking, which says if you have a pretty good idea that something might be going wrong, don't keep your foot to, you know, the pedal.
The pedal. Yeah, well, and it's interesting. It brings up two points, actually, Mark. One is whether you are, quote, guilty, which you could say, oh, while we were ignorant, we were not guilty. But it doesn't change how much we've put up there. I mean, it doesn't change. You know, you can take
responsible.
Exactly. The difference between guilt and responsibility. Exactly. Okay. So you were talking about this is Mark Hertzgaard, environmental correspondent for The Nation. We're talking about Copenhagen, from where he just returned. China U.S. relationship, and I had asked about the agreements that they negotiated prior to Copenhagen, and then the role both played in the agreements reached in Copenhagen.
Right. So I was very impressed by what they did before Copenhagen. You know, I was the first writer in 1996, under assignment for Vanity Fair, as a matter of fact, who went to China, and I was the first to describe and expose China's emergence as a climate change superpower. So I've been following this a long time. And what Obama did in November when he went to Beijing for his first summit with the Chinese leadership, I think was historic, because for the first time they came out with a statement, and for the first time you had the two climate change superpowers saying we're going to limit our emissions. And that was, they'd never said that to the world. And to me it was very reminiscent of the 1980s during the nuclear arms race and the first meeting that Gorbachev, after he became the Soviet leader, had with Ronald Reagan. And they said, they started talking about reducing emissions. And it was like both sides, they had pistols to each other's head, and they decided to put the pistols down on the table. A lot farther to go. You've got to take the bullets out of the pistols. You've got to dismantle the bullets. But it was a clear breakthrough. And I think that still is what happened in November. But in Copenhagen, where the next step needed to be taken, the two superpowers essentially remain stalemated, and that's a great shame.
And I've even read things that there were diplomatic, you know, maneuvers, kind of, that Wen was sending his second and thirds in command to meetings with Obama and so on. Do you make anything of that, or is really what we care about is the bottom line of what gets agreed to?
I think the bottom line is what matters. I would caution about those claims. Those were coming from the American side, who are obviously trying to spin the news towards the president. It is true, though, that the president did meet one-on-one with Wen. It is also true that Wen did send a second-in-command to a previous meeting, but it's not clear to me that the Chinese were aware of that previous meeting. I mean, it was a very chaotic day there. And I must say in that regard that many foreigners have criticized President Obama for not putting more attention to climate change in the lead up to this. And one of the things that would have helped a lot is if he had come not on the very last day of negotiations, but maybe a day or two beforehand to have avoided this kind of rushed diplomacy.
Mm-hmm. And what we do read is that, let me just, from today's New York Times, which they titled, their headline is "A Grudging Accord in Climate Talks." I'm going to read just a couple of things. "The final accord, a 12-paragraph document, was a statement of intention, not a binding pledge to begin taking action on global warming, a compromise seen to represent a flawed but essential step forward. The three-page accord that Mr. Obama negotiated with the leaders of China, India, Brazil, and South Africa, and then presented to the conference, did not meet even the modest expectations that leaders set for this meeting, notably by failing to set a 2010 goal for reaching a binding international treaty to seal the provisions of the accord. Nor does the plan firmly commit the industrialized nations or the developing nations to firm targets for midterm or long-term greenhouse gas emission reductions. The accord is nonetheless significant in that it codifies the commitments of individual nations to act on their own to tackle global warming." Okay, that's the New York Times. Couple of questions, Mark Hertzgaard. One, it does appear that while it would have, as you say, it would have been so much smarter and sounder, and sort of for someone who believes in dialogue and all of this horse trading and so on, to have shown up a couple of days earlier. On the other hand, in that final day, Obama, I'm speaking of, did meet, I believe, with China, India, Brazil, South Africa, and so on, hammer out something they could agree with, and then go to Europe and then finally the whole conference with what they'd agreed to. And sort of at this point, it's like sign on to this or not. But, I mean, in some sense, late as he was, he did put forth the effort that seems to have made a difference in them coming up with anything at all.
Well, yes, but do realize that this agreement is not a summit agreement. It's just an agreement by U.S., China, Brazil.
And South Africa.
And South Africa, and the EU has signed on. But the summit itself expressly declined to endorse this agreement. So we don't have a global agreement. We have, you know, you can say it's important or not important, but we have an agreement among a subset of countries, very big emitters, no doubt about it, but not an international agreement. And that's been a real problem in the press coverage. They've given the impression that there's a deal.
Yeah, it certainly has been blurry. And it, well, just the a grudging accord in climate talk, anybody who reads that doesn't think that accord means some people agreed or a few countries agreed. I think it sounds like, well, it was tough, but they made a deal.
Yeah, that's exactly it. In fact, I went in the inside of the press room that night. The early coverage of the New York Times was even worse on this, and their headline was, "Climate deal announced in Copenhagen."
Wow.
And I went to my colleagues and I said, "Hey, you know, guys, your headline is really fundamentally misleading here, because at that point the Europeans hadn't even signed on to it, much less the developing nations in the Group of 77. And to their credit, the reporters said, "You're right, we realize it, and we're trying to figure out how to rewrite it. And if you look, it's probably too late to do it now," but they backed away from that significantly and said in their later coverage, some key states made an agreement. So it is much less than people have made it out to be.
This accord is no agreement. Where does that leave us? And let me just read one other thing from the New York Times article. Many participants said the chaos and contentiousness of the talks may signal the end of reliance on a process that for almost two decades, back since Rio, had been viewed as the best approach to tackling global warming. This United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change and the series of 15 conventions following the 92 Climate Summit meeting in Rio. So where does this leave us?
That's a very big and very open question. I think many people, even before Copenhagen, were feeling great frustration with this process, and for the reasons that the New York Times story mentioned. But we also have to say that the United States in particular has not been very helpful towards this process. For the last 10 years, we've essentially told the rest of the world we have no interest in dealing with climate change. That was during the Bush-Cheney years. And when Obama came in, obviously he signaled a change in direction, but there's still a lot of resistance among the Republican Party in particular to doing something. So I think it might be a little early to write off that process, but it is certainly clear that the most important progress made on this issue has come from local state governments, regional governments, such as here in California, where we have decided to act regardless of what Washington thinks. And because California is such a big economy, we'd be the seventh largest economy in the world if we were separate from the rest of the United States, there has been some effect of that. And I think you're probably going to see a lot more of that kind of activity. I think you're also going to see a lot more, almost militants on the part of activists, because there's an enormous frustration, especially overseas, that so many people have invested so much time in this process, and the United States in particular simply didn't step up to the plate.
Okay, let me ask, I mean, it turned out, I think I wrote this question down before it turned out there was no agreement, but a quote from you, I believe, says Obama's speech, this is after his speech, but before the end of the conference, Obama's speech for the most part merely restated what has long been the U.S. position, a mere 4% reduction in U.S. greenhouse gas emissions by 2020, when science says reductions of at least 25 to 40% are necessary. People then say, well, you know, he's trying to reach two audiences there, the world and the U.S. And the U.S. never ratified Kyoto. And if I'm not mistaken, it got zero or one vote in the Senate.
That was never voted on.
Never voted on. Okay. I think there was a preliminary something that was 95-0.
Right.
Any treaty signed in Copenhagen or even later could be blocked by a mere 34 votes in the Senate. If people don't know that, treaties call for a two-thirds. So it's even worse than the 60 that they're laboring under these days for health care. It seems to me we're a long way from the U.S. ever agreeing to anything significant. And if you want to speak about the cap and trade legislation that is currently, sort of playing second fiddle to health care right now in the Senate and the House, where are we?
Well, I think that the key, you're right, and the argument that the administration will make is, look, Obama can't go farther than he did because of the Senate. We need to get this bill through the Senate. That's all the Senate will do. We're not even sure the Senate will do that. But there's two fundamental misconceptions here. One is this idea that dealing with climate change is going to hurt our economy. Fact is that, and the president has said this, that if we are smart, this will be the next big economic boom, is green energy, green technologies. And we could do far more than that 4% target just through investing in efficiency. And why do we know that? We know it because the biggest corporations in the world are already making money hand over fist doing exactly that. My favorite quick example here is Shell Oil Company, which in 1999 invested $20 million to make their facilities more energy efficient. So their factories, their refineries, their offices, they put in more efficient lighting, better motors that weren't so wasteful, and so forth. They spent $20 million, and 3 years later they had a look and said, well, what did this do? And they calculated that it had saved them $650 million.
Wow!
That's a 32 times larger than your initial investment. That's how much money they made. I mean, the mafia doesn't get that kind of
return
on investment.
If you'll allow me, the only investment corporations make that I think has a bigger return is when they give money to politicians.
Well, that's probably true.
But it's a damn good... I mean, that one sentence that you just gave, that Shell investing $20 million in what year?
1999.
And 3 years later, fine, they've saved $650
million? $650 million.
That's just the best news I've heard in a while.
Right. And that's what the private sector is doing. So why aren't we in the public sector? We're leaving that money on the table. That's got to stop immediately. And to his credit, Obama has begun to do some of that with the stimulus bill. We need to do a lot more, but the more important message is to get this idea out there. This idea that this is going to hurt our economy is just disinformation. It's not true.
Okay. And then what about the other thing, which is just prior to Copenhagen, the Environmental Protection Agency affirmed their authority that they can regulate greenhouse gas emissions, I guess, as a pollutant or as environmental protection. That can be done. Anything that can be done in that regard doesn't call for a treaty, correct?
That's correct. And that's the other reason that Obama could very easily have gone to Copenhagen and been much, much more ambitious in what he offered. If he would have said, I'm going to use the full extent of my executive authority, we're going to continue to work with the Congress, of course, but I'm going to use the full extent of my executive authority, and between those two things, with the EPA regulating emissions, like what they already do with cars and the amount of vehicle mileage that you have to get, but they can do that for power plants, for cement plants, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Between that and a massive investment in energy efficiency, we could easily here in the United States hit the 25% reductions by 2020, even more, that would have made Copenhagen a resounding success. Now, why doesn't Obama do that?
That was going to be my question.
All right, I'll tell you. The argument inside of Washington, and unfortunately it's one that is seen as gospel, not only within the administration, but with among congressional Democrats, and even many of the big environmental groups, they say, no, we can't use that EPA. We've got to just go with whatever the Senate will give us, because the EPA, if it won't last through a new president. You know, if a new president, a Republican president, for example, were to be elected in 2012, he could overturn the EPA rulings. And I suppose that makes sense, a certain amount of sense on paper, but I think it's really a silly way to look at politics, and here's why. If the EPA began those regulations starting now and pushed that kind of a proposal, it would send what economists call a price signal. it would say to the markets and to the hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars of investment capital that are waiting on the sidelines, eager to get into the clean energy business. If EPA began regulating, it would send the price signal that, yes, you're going to have that kind of price going forward, and those investments would begin, and it wouldn't matter in that case in 2012 if you got a new president who tried to overturn it. I don't think that president could do it, but it wouldn't matter because the price signal would have already been sent. Those investments would have begun. We'd be on the road to a clean, green economy, and there'd be no turning back.
Let me give the counter to, well, two things about that. One is, what we know about corporations is what they want more than anything else is reliable information, reliability, correct? In other words, that's why you're saying that if the EPA starts acting on that ruling, then people say, okay, that's the reality, and they can now begin to plan, invest, move strategy, and so on. And that until that happens, even though the climate is telling them they should be doing it, they're holding back. But you're saying that once they get that, then they can move. Second thing I would say is the Supreme Court is likely to rule very soon. We assume they've made the ruling. They just haven't announced it yet, and I've been waiting for it myself. Rule that corporations can that there are no limits on corporate investment in political campaigns. You know about that, right?
Sure.
Yeah. Now, one could make the case that, okay, if the Supreme Court does that and the industries, you know, go whole hog, that they could cripple these sorts of things and change the effects of elections and so on. But your sense is that once the movement begins, since every other signal, that is to say the signals from Europe, the signals from China, who seems to be investing heavily in these in the future of these things, the signals from the climate, from you know, climate change itself, that they would not reverse their field but would continue to move forward.
I think that's true of almost all of them. There will certainly be lawsuits from individual corporations who are still tied to the old polluting industry.
Coal companies.
But oil companies, you know, coal companies, et cetera. But those lawsuits would not stop the implementation of EPA regulations. And in the meantime, yes, there would be a price signal sent. There's all of this money that is sitting there waiting to go. And that, let's face it, has begun to move already in the past few years. There's a, you know, every time you pick up a copy of Business Week now, or even just read the newspapers or watch television, all the corporations are trying to tell us how green they are or want to be. Most of that is greenwash, but it's also true that there are a lot of people inside there who recognize that this is the next big growth area of the world economy. They recognize that China has already invested bundles in this, and that if the United States doesn't hurry up, we're going to be left irretrievably behind.
And that's right. In other words, we've got the trends that already favor China. If we give them this trend as well, this could be crucial. Let me give you two more minutes, and what I'd like you to do, just because we haven't dealt with it, is what is the difference that people see right now between 350 and 450, between 2 degrees and 1.5 degrees Celsius change, which is kind of what we're talking about?
Right. Well, we're talking about 2 degrees Celsius over and above the temperatures that prevailed on Earth throughout the pre-industrial era. That is, from the time that our species arose, there's been a basic sort of average temperature. That's what our civilization developed in. That's what all of the ecosystems around us have adapted to. And that's what we are now interfering with through global warming. So far, we've raised the temperature about 0.9 degrees Celsius over the pre-industrial era. And because of the inertia of the system, that's the climate system, the chemistry and physics of all this, mean that since carbon dioxide stays in the atmosphere for centuries, we are already locked in to another half degree. So we're already to about 1.3 or 1.4. We could stop all the emissions tonight, and because of that lag effect, we would still see temperatures rising for another 40 years. That's why we've got to stop them as soon as possible. Even if we did, it'd be very hard to hit the 1.5 degree limit. So many people say 2.0 degrees. That is the one sort of concrete thing that came out of Copenhagen, that the Chinese have now agreed to that, but they so there's no guarantees about how we're going to get there in that accord. And unfortunately, even 2 degrees C is going to mean an enormous amount of damage. As I said earlier, here in California, our glaciers are already melting. We're today at 390 parts per million, and we're melting, and the storms are coming harder, and the droughts, and the sea level rise. So we've absolutely got to turn this around as quickly as possible.
Okay, let me leave it at that. You can listen to this week's conversation and many others at any time during the week by linking to our podcast. You can also sign up to have it delivered to you weekly for podcasts, articles, and transcripts, and to join me in pursuit of a world that just might work. Go to TerrenceMcNally.net. That's TerrenceMcNally, one word, .net. And if you want to receive my weekly announcement of who's going to be on and what we're going to talk about, that's email me at T.E. McNally at Mac.com. And Mark Hertzgard, let me tell you that when I set out to do this hour, I wondered if we could follow the history, the present, the future, and so on in 1 hour, and I think we did a great job. Thank you very much.
Always a pleasure, Terrence.
Okay, keep up your good work.